Harrison studied me briefly from his prime real estate across the table. He slowly rubbed his chin with his left hand while he considered my offer. He pursed his lips and began tapping them very slowly. Narrowing his hazel eyes, he said, "How much?" He waited for my reply calmly, knowingly. He wasn't smiling, but he wasn't not smiling either. Under the table, I picked at the skin on my thumb, ripping off a strand suddenly lost. What were we talking about? Why was he looking at me like that? Did I have food on my face? I looked at all the other people at the table. Coincidentally, they were all looking at me as well. Why was everybody looking at me? I must have food on my face. I wiped the corners of my mouth with my now slightly bleeding hand. How much for what? I asked them sadly. I'm a little lost. What scene is this? Now I sounded as if I was pleading. Not for my life, necessarily, but for a way to live it nobly, like a poet on a porch. They laughed when I asked what scene it was. Harrison didn't laugh, but he looked as though he might have if he'd been made a different way. Then I remember at least part of it. Play the zither! I'm going to pay you to play the zither! Now, Harrison said. Yes! That was the first I had laughed. We all laughed. Maybe everything would be all right now. Sure, that was it. It was a sign. It all started and ended with the zither. And something else, too. I was going to go home with Harrison. I wasn't sure up until that moment, and I wasn't sure of what would happen after I went home with him. I knew it wasn't a good idea. It would never be a good idea, but it wouldn't be a really bad one either. I mean, weird and grumpy as he may have been, he wasn't a bad human. He was much more on the good side of the bad, good human graph. He was bad and good, like most people. A good person who does bad things or a bad person who does good things. As long as people are involved, people will do bad or good things to them, especially when there's money and small dogs involved. The check was fought for valiantly by all us available good soldiers, understanding as we did, on some dark and smiling level, that those blessed with the bounty of backed-up seamen would actually pay it. Koo and I played at being semi-cloyingly grateful for the gallant sacrifice of their hard-won shekels, and we rose from our four-sided trough, thus easing our way out of our eatery and on to the finer events that no doubt awaited us all. I was in no shape to do anything but take cues, when and if they were distributed with intent. But perhaps I had misread the situation. Was I following a lead that only existed in my unaccustomed to alcohol and as such altered mind? But I was slowly sobering up, and the likelihood that I was misreading signals was getting lower by the minute as we stood on the sidewalk outside the little Italian restaurant I'd so recently managed to survive. The cool air was welcome. Who knew there was so much of it outside, especially when compared to the overall quantity of air set aside for eateries? We stood under the timid light of a nearby street lamp, shuffling from one foot to the other, checking watches, lighting cigarettes, or squinting into the night to ascertain whether or not there were any incoming cabs. "I'm in Chelsea," Mark said. "So you decided to keep that place in the end?" Peter observed, nodding wisely. Mark shrugged. "Well, in the end, I figured why not. It's got great views, an awesome kitchen. I mean, sure, there are better neighborhoods, but..." He paused and shrugged again. "But not with a second bedroom." Harrison flicked away his barely smoked Camel and coughed. "Okay," he said to everyone. He then looked at me. "I can drop you at your place. It's on my way." He took my arm and steered me toward Piccadilly Circus. Good night, I managed as Harrison drew me along into the street and away from them. That I didn't stumble was a miracle. Not like the virgin birth or anything, but you could have fooled me. We walked in silence for several moments while I rifled through an assortment of remarks I might make, enabling me to seem, well, to seem like someone, a woman even, who knew what she was doing, or didn't care what she was doing because wherever she went, only the very best people would follow. Follow her every word like welcome stalkers. Why wouldn't Harrison want to be where she was? If only she felt this way about herself. If only she could think of what to say to him, other than ask him what they were doing, where they were going, and why. Would he ask her to the prom and cover her in hickeys? Well, now, of course, she loved him, didn't she? She wouldn't have dared to before the business in the back seat, but now... What's your address? He asked, startling me. Standing there beside this king, Han Solo and all the other characters he would eventually play seated in him now. And then there was me, pregnant with all those people I would play. A vengeful hairdresser, a hostile mother-in-law, a flute-playing adulteress, a psychologist, a drug-addicted writer, a boyfriend-poaching actress, a boy-hungry casting director, myself, an unfaithful wife, an angry boss, myself, and a couple of nuns. He took me by the elbow and eased all of us into the back seat of a taxi. What's your address? I looked at him, blinking. My address? Where are we going, ladies and gents? The driver put the taxi in gear and it growled back to life. Or I could drive you kids around all night. It's your money. Harrison nodded in agreement, twirling his index finger rapidly, the international indicator to hurry things along. Oh, fine. Esmond Court, off Kensington High Street. All right, love, have you there in a jiff, he all but cheered in his cockney Dick Van Dyke East End accent. The one I wish I had. That's behind Barker's, is it? I was about to tell him when Harrison pulled me back into the seat, moving us closer and closer together, face to face, until we were two faces, four eyes, one kiss, going to the places where we could rehearse that kissing we would be doing a year and a half later in The Empire Strikes Back. And apparently we wanted to get a jump on it, as it were. People think you just kiss in a love scene. They don't realize the years some actors put into those scenes. Real actors. All that practice really shows. But you don't have to take my word for it. Check out those kisses in Empire. See? Those were years in preparation, and I promise you they did not have to use any special effects there. These were the early days and nights of the Force. That Force. Here we are, folks, Esmond Court. This was punctuated by the sharp sound of the pulled brake. That'll be £5.10, please. Harrison reached around to retrieve his brown beat-up wallet from his back pocket. I pulled my bag from the floor and into my lap, saying, I could... He looked at me, indicating that what remained of the sentence I had started would be less than welcome. I may have become a blush factory, sending southerly blood to my northerly face for a visit. It now occurred to me, belatedly, I admit, that Harrison wasn't just dropping me off, but that we were very likely going to be having what my friends and I referred to as a sleepover. What if he... If we... And then... Oh, God... Then he would leave me with my new slutty sense of myself established in one fell swoop. A fallen woman flat on her face, swooping for all she was worth. Leia would never get herself into a situation like this. Actually, she probably would. But not until the sequels. This was sequel behavior. Oh, but what if she did get into the backseat of a taxi with a smuggling married actor? If she did happen to do that, She wouldn't just go along with things like a leaf on a rushing stream. Come on, she'd be able to come up with something more unusual. Maybe not poetic, but why was I so obedient? What would Leia do? Obviously, it would be very different than following Jesus' example. Jesus would hardly, well, it's no use perusing Jesus' lead when it came to dating. And is that what this was? Dating? Oh, Leia, where are you when I need you? Oh, Jesus, if you're watching, please don't let my stomach look other than flat if it should get to that. Cheers, mate, the cabbie said as Harrison paid the fare. He then drove off, leaving us in something better than a lurch. You want to come up? I asked absurdly. He almost laughed. Sure. I reached into my bag for my keys. Leia found them and led him into the building to her apartment. And Carrie spent the rest of the night making sequels with her future cinematic husband. How would it all end? Would it all end? And how would I look when it did? It's difficult to recall with any kind of clarity details from that weekend. I mean, even if I could, what are we talking about here? Soft porn for hardened sci-fi fans? I can't remember events from yesterday or earlier tonight when I put away my credit card for safekeeping. Now, for the life of me, I don't know precisely what safekeeping is. What I do know about that weekend is more along the lines of what didn't happen. I know we didn't have an in-depth conversation about anything. So, if we didn't spend a bunch of time talking or playing Monopoly, then we must have done more physical things. Long walks, waterboarding, things of that nature. Oh, but why be coy or discreet? We had a sleepover, you know, like we made a fort with pillows after we had a really big pillow fight. Then we called his mom and got permission for him to stay overnight, but we couldn't stay up too late because we had school on Monday, and besides which, we were in the school play! All I can remember after he followed me into the apartment and turned on the hallway light was that I meant to show him around my little flat, only now our fumbling was not in a moving vehicle driven by a knowing spectator. We were once again practicing for our cinematic snog. The bedroom couldn't get dark enough. Even with the lights off, I still wanted to turn the lights out. I didn't want him to recognize me from the movies. Hey, weren't you in that scene we shot today? Don't I know you from Cloud City? Okay, so now we'd spoken together with our words. We'd bantered together using George's words. Now we were exploring the outer reaches of no-speak, of memorizing the bottom of each other's faces with our mouths. If you'd told me that morning when my bed was being used for other purposes, then, well, if I didn't know Star Wars was going to be that big of a hit, how could I have predicted the stars of Star Wars would find themselves in bed together? I don't believe people are across the board confident. If they are, well, they've misjudged the situation where there's an arrogant result. Mostly people have those few things they do well and hope those things make up for the other shit. Why am I telling you this? Partly because with my combination of insecurity and inexperience, I was paralyzed. Scared to say anything that might make Harrison leave me in the lurch that had all too recently been Riggs' apartment. A tiny part of me felt like I'd won the man lottery, and here I was both counting and spending the money. Our skin agreed. We pressed our luck, first his, then mine, then ours, until we had smoothed our way into the thick of it, until nothing else was possible except to get through to each other, in and on through each other until we eased into the other side, not the dark side. Suffice to say, we survived and then some. Difficult from this distance to know how close our close was, and whether this brand of close had much to do with the proximity of someone who looked so very much like my space date, he who smirked at me while jumping to light speed, while I required no assistance whatsoever. Our affable ordeal behind us, Harrison fell asleep, and I pretended to. God, he was handsome. I forgave him for not loving me in the way one usually expects, and almost forgave myself for not expecting it. I tried to follow him into slumberland, and when I couldn't, I breathed with him there in the dark, wondering what he was dreaming, and hoping that if I actually managed to fall asleep, in the morning I would wake up before he did. Maybe I'd be better at talking with him now, less daunted, in character and out. There are some things that I still consider private. Amazing, isn't it? You would think, without concentrating too hard, that I consider whatever I said and did up for grabs, way up where the grabs are groped the most. But sex is private. That might be one reason we do it, for the most part, in the nude. Clothes falling away signals a situation that I'll likely avoid putting into words. If clothes don't dress it up, don't expect talk to either. So it is with uncharacteristic reservation and scruple that I quash any details, put the kibosh on sharing anything but the most general information or description hereinafter when relating what occurred between Mr. Ford and me on that fateful Friday night in May 1976. This applies also to whatever it was that occurred between Harrison and me on subsequent Friday nights at ungodly hours. For that is when we spent our time together, when we had our sleepovers, like good youngsters do. Oh, we spent time together during daylight hours following our time together at night, such as it was. I think I recall his reading the paper while I pretended to do something else. Privacy questions aside, I can barely recall our time together during our first weekend. I didn't know how I would live through the 5 whole days of filming following that first weekend. Those 5 days on the set together went unbearably slowly, with our having to behave toward each other as though the weekend before hadn't even occurred. Weekdays were off-limits, intimacy-wise. Not that this had ever been expressly stated by either one of us. We simply intuited we would spend our weekdays treating one another as though not only had that first weekend not happened, but all of the ensuing ones hadn't happened either, and wouldn't. Despite the common use of the phrase going out with to describe two people spending time together, Harrison and I didn't spend a lot of time going out. Instead, we went into each other's apartments. I remember spending most of our weekends together at my rented domain in Esmond Court, but that could just be where my memory goes when I send it back to the 70s. I know I wanted to spend our time together there and not at his place. I preferred Harrison staying over at my apartment because, well, as the borrowed flat of a friend of mine, it was nicer than his. Sorry, but it was. We all received scale for the first film, which amounted to about $500 a week or something. And while I came from a wealthy family, though of recently reduced circumstances, and could have afforded rent for nice accommodations, even if I hadn't been able to borrow Riggs' flat, Harrison had a wife and 2 children at home. So in order to maintain their support, he lived in the most modest housing that the studio could get away with providing him. So when it came down to where we would stay, the choice became fairly obvious soon enough. Once, on one of the rare occasions when we did have a sleepover at Harrison's apartment, Mark and his fairly ubiquitous friend Peter dropped by unannounced. It was about 11 o'clock in the morning, and it might have looked odd that I was there. Clearly I hadn't just dropped by for brunch, as no scones or eggs were in evidence, and we didn't appear to be running lines. Harrison, after letting Mark in, returned to the table we'd been sitting at, sat down across from me, took my hand, and pronounced solemnly, "We're engaged." It was hiding in plain sight, mocking the suggestion that there was anything going on. Therefore, it couldn't be true, a technique I like to use to this day. But I also know that I wasn't good at being clear about anything that I wanted with Harrison. I could charm the birds out of everyone's trees but his. That's something I wrote in the diaries that I kept during the filming of Star Wars. The first one, Episode 4. The diaries I found recently while expanding my bedroom at home. I was going through the many boxes that were stored romantically beneath the floorboards and came across three written notebooks I had kept during that epic time and then promptly forgot I'd kept. Or that they kept me, in some ways, sane. When I read them, I was struck by how unusual they were, which is when I first considered publishing them. I still might. What do you think? There were two reasons that I wrote the diaries, the first one being that I'd always written since I was about 12. It seemed to calm me, getting anything that might be chaotic behind the eyes onto the page in front of me where it could do me less harm. Along the lines of saying, better out than in, though that usually refers to vomit. Maybe more like, better an empty house than an unhappy tenant. Not that writing on my notepads managed to actually empty my mind, though some would argue, but I was grateful to relieve the overflow. The second reason I wrote them was that I couldn't talk to Harrison. Basically about anything, but especially about the entity that was us. Not that there actually was such a thing. Not only couldn't I converse with Harrison, but given that my weekends with Harrison were a secret, it became something that was better left unsaid to discuss only with my pen in hand, with the journal in front of me. I felt that I couldn't confide in anyone else what was happening with Harrison because Harrison was married, and not to me. So, it might get awkward if I told a person about us, because then that person might tell someone else. And that person would tell another person, until eventually Harrison's wife might hear about it and react other than positively about it in the extreme. And nobody wanted that. Not that Harrison and I ever discussed not wanting it. It was an understood not wanting. I think that might be an overall understanding one arrives at, either verbally or otherwise, when you're having an affair with someone who is unaccountably a married person. Unless perhaps the wedded individual tells you his wife doesn't understand him, which is why he wants to leave her to be with you. Or, in this instance, me. And no one was telling anyone that they felt misunderstood. And as such, there wouldn't be anything leaving-wise in this instance. So that was that. I only know about the understandings you have with married men and such from movies or books. Never had an affair with a married man. That was me. I'd barely had understandings with a single man, and I've never been with someone wedded since. As I may have mentioned, I had really only had a relationship of any sort with one human being prior to my being with Harrison. But Harrison didn't know that right away. All he knew was, well, essentially nothing prior to our initial weekend of untold romance and unforgettable passion. I mean, you know, general stuff that you write on forms. Name, parents, siblings, friends, schools, plus anecdotes intended, no doubt, to hold me up to a good light. Amusing stories! How fun I was! How easygoing and irresistible was I! What I didn't know was that Harrison may have been listening to me before we were together that weekend. You know, to what I said, specifically about men. Listening for anything confirming that I was an available and experienced gal. He could have been gathering these rosebuds in order to come to the conclusion that he might have wanted to come to. Well, or the one he ultimately came to anyway. The conclusion that it would be okay to take me home with him. Or take me to my house with him with me. And that was that. All through the Star Wars work week, I waited in vain for some indication that A, we had ever been together at all, or had I imagined the entire event? And, or B, if indeed it had occurred, would it ever occur again in any form, ranging from another inarticulate weekend to finally marrying, after a discrete amount of time had elapsed since his eventual and uncomplicated divorce? I'm sure that on our relative list of priorities as we went about filming, I may have ranked as high as number 15 on his agenda, while Harrison was my number one. So this was the way I made it from that first weekend to that second. Would we share another monosyllabic weekend? Or would I spend the ensuing Saturday and Sunday virtually alone, wondering what I'd done to already push him away? How could I have, when we had barely been that close, just close enough to ignite an almost full-on obsession in me? But spend a second weekend we did. Once again, we were together in our apart way. We met at the North Star Pub in St. John's Wood between Elstree and central London. I'm sure I selected the place because it was the pub that I had gone to when I was at drama college all those many months ago. Months from when I dropped out of drama college in order to star in a space fantasy called Star Wars, which must have seemed like decades before that evening at the North Star, because essentially everything in my life had now changed. I was no longer a drama student doing Shakespeare and Ibsen with a fellow student boyfriend. I was now an actual actress with a job in a film that took place in a galaxy far, far away. A space fantasy. Perfect. And now I was having an affair with my co-star from that film, just like I pretended to want, without understanding what that meant. And here I was in a pub in London having a drink with him after a day of filming. I believe I may have previously mentioned that Harrison was not a garrulous person. Given that, as we sat in the public house, I inadvertently held my breath quite a bit. A lot. While fretting over what I would and would not say during that evening. I knew, without believing it, that I would not say a charmingly hell of a lot. I would be calm and succinct and ask thoughtful questions and then listen to his answers intently. Had I been able to manifest the demeanor just described, this would have been the night he discovered yet another of my many characteristics that would cause him to rethink any less than positive opinions he had obviously prematurely formed. He would wonder where I had been all his life, and then recall with a bemused, ironic, sinking feeling that I had yet to be born for much of it. The important thing was that at least he'd met me now. He would remind himself to try to make up for all of our lost time for the rest of our compatible lives. But for now, we didn't think about ever needing to make up for anything, as we had barely amassed any amount of time together at all. In fact, though, what happened was Harrison and I both began to drink, and at some point early on I said, "Do you want to see me do an imitation of you?" Harrison didn't really walk, he swaggered, moving a bit like John Wayne in slow motion. He would take his seemingly bad attitude for a walk. In order to depict this, I moved out of sight around the corner from Harrison, and after a moment reappeared, strolling as he strolled, sauntering my way into whatever fresh hell I found myself in. I'd become him, disenchanted Lord Ford, master of all he surveyed, if he got around to it. I studied my environment with bored, disenchanted eyes and smirking mouth, behaving as if wherever I'd inadvertently found myself was no doubt some pathetic, watering hellhole for a bunch of needy posers and poser wannabes, who unfortunately didn't have the stuff to interest me, him. I hadn't looked at Harrison yet to see how my portrayal of him was going over, too busy appearing indifferent and impatient with my surroundings. I'd get around to him in good time, Until then, what criminally inept person had decorated this room I was in? Decorated? More like defiled. Wow! I was amazed my eyes weren't bleeding from the insult some referred to as interior. Shouldn't that be inferior? Decoration. As I continued to portray his inner monologue, as I imagined it, I finally let at least one of my eyes slide wearily over to his face, and saw that he was not only laughing, he was laughing that silent and hard laugh reserved for true enthusiasm. Almost 40 years later, I still think of it as one of the greater moments of my life. My love life. I tried not to let my relief interrupt my imitation and return my gaze to the disenchanting room around us, but I didn't intend for my betrayal to go on much longer. Why press my luck? I mean, this could really be a game changer. If my portrait of my co-star as a smug, scruffy-looking nerf herder went well enough, Harrison could unexpectedly, but gently and responsibly, leave his wife, and after a barely noticeable dignified amount of time, he would marry me in an unsentimental, tasteful way. And we would subsequently astonish everyone, including ourselves, by remaining together for the rest of whoever died first's life. And all because I dared to do an imitation of him for him in the pub one night. That was the beginning of his realizing that I was the only person with whom he felt comfortable enough to be, well, still uncomfortable, but now at peace with finding the world a constant disappointment. I continued to swagger toward him, and then next to him, finally letting my eyes return to him. To my amazement, I now saw that he was still laughing, which almost caused me to laugh, but instead, I was able to maintain my portrayal, stretching my lips to their side limits to indicate what perhaps might be identified as a smile, but what turned out to be a cease between scowls, before returning my expression to its relaxed smirk mode. I remember distinctly that this was the part of my impression that amused him the most. Not that anything could convince me that our little dalliance was much more than that. A summer romance without the romance. Or without the summer, for that matter. Now that I had elicited this amazingly enthusiastic response from him, the danger was that I would want to get him laughing like a human during all our upcoming evenings together. It was bad enough that I was doing it already tonight. Please, God, don't let me feel the need to encourage him to be Mr. Chuckles on the set as well. That would be a great idea, right? Making it my life's work to cause Han Solo to giggle his way through an asteroid field, or howl with laughter at how ridiculously hairy his Wookiee co-pilot was. How about a spit take in full view of some unobtrusive Minox? No, Harrison was not on this earth for me to goad into uncontrollable fits of laughter. I would have to control the impulse to entertain him. Most importantly, so as not to call attention to the possibility that we were more than just co-stars. Maybe not much more, where he was concerned, but I was not so lucky. Men. If I'd never succeeded in coaxing this coveted laughter of his out into the waiting world, I would never have known what I was missing. Just that I was missing something, besides his not being single or accessible or, for the most part, warm. I wouldn't have been able to imagine his laughing wholeheartedly or known how amazing it felt to actually be with the person you were with and feel that he liked you. You know, in that ongoing let's keep seeing each other way. This was the first time I felt as though Harrison liked me. Not because he wanted to sleep with me or because no one else was around in a way that was convenient. He liked me. I'd made him laugh. I'd done an imitation of him for him, even though I was afraid of how he'd react, and it had worked out. Take a risk, win a prize. Or borrow someone else's prize for the duration of the film and hope things aren't too awkward when you film the sequels. When he'd returned to his paranormal self, we sat smiling at each other, each waiting for the other to... what? Say something. Say something! I do other imitations, I finally offered, my shoulders up to my ears in a shrug. But I don't think they'd go too well in this particular environment. He lit a new cigarette, and I quickly retrieved one of mine, letting him light it with another match while avoiding his eyes. I went on. Well, Judy Garland for one, but you probably wouldn't like it. Why? Well, it's pretty loud and includes some dancing and a lot of makeup. He nodded, picking some nicotine off the tip of his tongue and flicking it away. Any more quiet ones, like mine? I thought for a moment, searching for a funny reply. What to say? Make him laugh. Make him like me. Oh, please make him like me. Then everything will be fine. Or thereabouts. But no punchlines came to deliver that body blow that would reignite the blaze of his smile. What a jerk I was. I've always been a jerk and always will be. He hates me now and thinks I'm boring and stupid. B and S. I could do an imitation of my college boyfriend. He was super quiet. Super. Who says super and lives? Certainly not me. Harrison raised his eyebrows slightly. Oh? Well, yeah, maybe all boyfriends are quiet. Not boyfriends. Harrison was my boyfriend and would never be. Fix this! Well, I wouldn't know about all boyfriends, really, I rattled on. Simon's really the first boyfriend I ever had. And I don't really... I'm not actually looking to... Harrison's face had whitened, and his eyes were suddenly concerned. A slight frown threatened. What do you mean, your only boyfriend? I blinked. What had I done now? I struggled for something to say. What about all those guys you talked about? He asked. That Rob guy, the photographer, and Fred, and Buck, and... Still frowning, I said, Fred? I didn't sleep with him. I know him. Hey, you know him, too. Does that mean you slept with him? Not waiting for a response, I continued somewhat indignantly. I don't sleep with all the men I know, and I don't sleep with them just because I bring them up in conversation. Christ, if you thought that I slept with every man who found himself in some story of mine, you must think I'm a hooker or something. A slut! So I guess that made it all right for you. Made what all right? The fuck hookers, you're big slutty co-star. Me! He interrupted. All right, enough. Fine. I said, totally sulking. But you shut up also. A version of that happened. A much toned-down version, maybe with fewer words and a lot less volume. Harrison was looking at the rug on the floor in front of him, blinking. Why was he so upset? What did he want me to have slept with everyone with a penis that I brought up in conversation? He seemed disappointed that I was as inexperienced as I'd suddenly revealed myself to be, that I considered confessing that I'd let Buck feel me up under my shirt after the shampoo wrap party, and then felt like a slut for days, but instead kept silent and watched the side of his suddenly serious face for clues as to why it was a bad idea that I'd only really been with him and Simon. Oh, okay, and I'd slept with Griffin once in Las Vegas, but that didn't count because he was a friend and we never did it again. I thought men liked it if you were inexperienced. Was that only in Victorian times? Hadn't I once heard that some men even paid to deflower a girl? Not that Harrison had deflowered me in any way, as though you could deflower someone a little. If so, was thy then implying that he had maybe batted away a petal in the deflowering process? What was I meant to do here? How could I return him to the laughing Harrison from just moments ago, a time that, in the ensuing confusion, was now rapidly beginning to feel like weeks ago? Would he ever completely forgive me for not being sexually, sophisticated, experienced? For being a 19-year-old who, despite using four-letter words with such ease and familiarity, didn't turn out to be the pro, scarlet woman, tramp, nymphomaniac I seemed to be. It didn't occur to me, until decades later, that perhaps what disturbed Harrison was the implication that he was subsequently burdened with something very like responsibility, in that he had somehow been given a gift he hadn't wanted or expected. Well, we all know what happened after that. We slowly fell deeper and deeper in love, he more than I, for obvious reasons. It was truly a surprise to us both. The night he took my hand in his and weepingly admitted that, though he loved his wife very much, they had been growing apart for quite some time now, so that when he met me, he knew I was the person he wanted to spend the rest of his life with. Both public and private. I was his soulmate, understanding him in ways he never thought possible. Here he had to stop speaking, he was crying so much, tears streaming down his manly face, blowing his nose into his hand and wiping it on his shirt. He whispered, "Fate brought us together in space, but we brought ourselves together on Earth. But whether on Saturn or in South Kensington, please do me the honor of being the companion I share my life with." That was when he slipped a ring on my finger that I never take off except when I'm waxing my knuckles, a gold band with diamonds spelling out the word he came up with, kerosene. We also use it as a gate code in the home we share in London, in St. John's Wood near the North Star Pub. So we'll always be within walking distance of that place where we first discovered the shared passion that would continue secretly throughout our ongoing, enviable lives. How can I paint for you the picture of this brief 3-month break in the bad weather of no feeling? Sadly, I cannot. And this is not because of the memory loss that typically comes with age, though that is a distinct factor. It is the memory loss that comes with marijuana use, though in this case it is not the long-term use that has deprived me of the recollections from these months from long ago. It is the 3-month ingestion of what seemed to be the brutal strength of Harrison's preferred strain of pot. This is what takes any and all vivid recollections and crushes them beneath its cruel inhaled heel. At the time, the reefer took whatever certainty I possessed while in Harrison's company and traded it for paranoia so intense it took my breath away. What I recall from the rubble of my brain cells is the discomfort I experienced between waking and sleeping, trying to think of something to say other than, "Do you love me?" or "Why are you with me at all?" Or, "Do you know your lines for next week?" Or, "Can I get you another beer?" Or, "Where did you get that scar on your chin?" By the way, I believe the answer to that question had the words acid and girl with freckles in it. And the toilet seat hit my head and cracked this cut in my chin. But I am more than probably wrong. I also doubt much of this was actually said per se, but I know he lay on his back on the couch in Riggs's apartment telling me the story, and if he did say any of it, I'm sure he made it up. Though there has been some speculation regarding my drug use during Star Wars, I used nothing other than Harrison's pot on the weekends during that first film. After that, marijuana was no longer possible for me. It had such a powerful, all-consuming effect on me that I have never used that drug again. In effect, I can't remember now what I was too uncomfortable to remember at the time, for 3 months. From celebration to intoxication to assignation to infatuation to imitation to indignation. This was my trimester of the affair that was Carrison. Harrison finished shooting first. My last scenes would be 2 weeks later, so I decided to go back to L.A. for a break and wound up flying there with Harrison. Now, I wasn't in charge of the movie's travel arrangements, so I couldn't have organized things so that he and I sat together, but sit together we did for a full 14 hours in coach. I didn't know if he was pleased with these arrangements because he didn't exhibit emotions, and I didn't record it in the journals I kept, but we did wind up talking. Anyway, whatever I don't remember of our conversation on the flight, I do remember he was kind. Very kind. Kind enough to enable me to close the door on our cinematic episode together, both on and off screen, without regret. Which was quite a turn of events when you consider those silent weekends. "I'm a hick," I recall saying to him. "No," Harrison answered. "You think you're less than you are. You're a smart hick." And then, "You have the eyes of a doe and the balls of a samurai." It's the only thing he ever said to me that acknowledged any intimacy between us, and it was enough. Not only because it had to be, but because of what I'm assuming it cost him to go that out of character in conversation. We never again acknowledged that anything of that nature had occurred. Anyway, I keep mentioning these diaries. The ones I kept during the filming of the first Star Wars, the diaries I'd forgotten about but recently found. By now, you're all ears. More eyes. Time for the reveal.
Notes from His Periphery, or The Glib Martyr. One could never call me a quitter. I take something right and see it through till it's wrong. Auctioning myself off to the lowest bidder, going once, going twice, gone. Sold to the man for the price of disdain, some are sold for a song. I don't rate a refrain. I guess it was all going just a little too well. If I wasn't careful, I'd be happy pretty soon. Heaven's no place for one who thrives on hell, one who prefers the bit to the silver spoon. Then, just when I'd almost resigned myself to winning, when it seemed my bright future would never dim, when my luck looked as though it was only beginning, I met him. Sullen and scornful, a real Marlboro man, the type who pours out the beer and eats the can, a tall guy with a cultivated leer. One you can count on to disapprove or disappear. I knew right away that he was a find. He knew that you had to be cruel to be kind. Given this, he was the kindest man I'd ever met. Back came my sense of worthlessness and my long-lost pangs of regret. I was my old self again, lost and confused. Reunited with that old feeling of being misunderstood and misused. Sold to the man for the price of disdain. All of this would be interesting if it weren't so mundane. He is like a fantasy. The inevitability of his escape is most likely his most attractive feature. He submits to the silences without a struggle. I go under shrugging and sighing, finally overcome by the sheer weight of the pause-turned, lull-turned way of life. Silence speaks louder than words. It screams, "Boring!" He's boring and tries to make it look more like a decision than an accident. The silences make my composure decompose from the inside out. I wonder what he is like inside out. We often assume that when the surface offers so little, the depth must be unfathomable. Whatever is inaccessible must be worthwhile. I hate him in all of his quiet, but I love the implied disapproval, the seniority, the sternness, the disdain, the strong silent type. frightening, awful silences, hiding behind all those mannerisms and quiet, crouched down behind himself, unfiltered cigarettes, beer, broads, and lumberjack shirts, and all that quiet to read into. One not only has to read between the lines, one has to fill him in altogether, because he's not there. To make him important in one's life requires an overactive imagination. Unfortunately, mine never knows when to quit. During the long stretches of silence, one can study him, eventually filling him in to suit one's likes or dislikes, the satisfaction of one's fantasy. I have filled him in to be unobtainable, disinterested, attractive, and bored with my company, my ideal mate, someone to endure, never to enjoy. I am totally at his mercy. I suffer through the silence, imagining that he is suffering my company, that I am merely an alternative for nothing better to do. I'm frightened of the power I have given him over me, and of how he will almost certainly abuse it, merely by not being fully aware he has it. So he assumes his apathetic poker face, and I sit practicing wry, knowing looks somewhere in his periphery. I don't dare pick a topic for fear that it won't be funny enough or interesting enough for his awe-inspiring judgment. With his silence, he establishes himself as a sort of trapped audience. And so you break your ass to meet the enormous challenge of entertaining him, frantic with worry that his teeth might suffocate. Oh, he's very funny sometimes with his parched sense of humor, but he only plays himself part-time. I work myself around the clock. Obviously, I've not heard about the child labor laws. But then, I have not totally accepted that I am no longer a child. Once I do that, I will have to accept responsibility for everything I do. We have no feeling for one another. We lie buried together during the night and haunt each other by day, acting out something that we don't feel and seeing through something that doesn't deserve any focus. I have never done anything quite like this. I sit patiently, awaiting the consequences. I talk, walk, eat, and sleep patiently, awaiting the consequences. How can a thing that doesn't seem to be happening come to an end? George says that if you look at the person someone chooses to have a relationship with, you'll see what they think of themselves. So Harrison is what I think of myself. It's hardly a relationship, but nevertheless, he is a choice. I examined all the options and chose the most likely to leave. No emotional investments, never love for me, only obsession. Someone has to stand still for you to love them. My choices are always on the run. I can't think about it anymore. It makes my head hurt. My mind works overtime trying to rationalize it, categorize it, define it, until it no longer means anything. Put it into words. You can't feel words. I think that if I could give a name to what I feel, it would go away. Find the word that describes the feeling and say it over and over until it's merely a sound. That old familiar feeling of hopelessness, that vague sense of desperation, fighting not to lose something before you've decided what you've got. I must thank him someday for teaching me to be casual. I realize I'm not very adept at it yet, but given a certain amount of time, I feel I could learn to act as though I wanted to be somewhere else, maybe even manage to look as though I was somewhere else. I can charm the birds out of everybody else's trees but his. Vultures are difficult to charm unless you're off somewhere rotting in the noonday sun. Casually rotting. A glib cadaver. I'm sorry it's not Mark. It could have been. It should have been. It might have meant something. Maybe not much, but certainly more. This is a totally unreal situation, but it's the only reality I've got. I call friends trying to recapture some of my old dime store perspective, but no matter how long we talk or how deep we delve, I can't seem to make any of it stick. I don't really know how any of this feels. It's important to decide whether all this is right or wrong, but as I've always seemed to judge myself in terms of other people's standards and opinions, I have no moral reserves of my own to tap. I've always relied on the kindness of strangers, acquaintances, friends, relatives, and Tennessee Williams to see me through. I'm quite sure, though, that if I had any principles, what I'm doing now would violate most all of them. I suspect that no matter what happens, I will allow it to hurt me. Eat away at my insides, as it were, as it will be, as it always has been. Why am I so accessible? Why do I give myself to people who will always and should always remain strangers? I have always relied on the cruelty of strangers, and I must stop it now. I am a fool. I need a vacation from myself. I'm not very good at it lately. Who do you want them to think you are? How do you think people see you? Or don't you let them near enough to see? You make up their minds for them. Do you think that you succeed in convincing people that you are what you seem to be? You make people meet you on your own territory. You don't help them. You let them verbally hang themselves and then feel better about yourself, your power, your own sense of worth. You have the power to alienate them, and if they allow it, you might even manage to make them feel awkward and foolish. Foolish for letting you affect them at all. Do you want them to like you? Or are you one of those people who don't care what people think? You're not living your life for them, so why should you give a fuck what people think? You make people come to you, and when they eventually do, you punish them with your smugness. Nothing ever out of character. I wish you would love me more so that I could love you less. Not written by me. The man sitting alone, so silent and strong. So what if you're attracted for all the wrong reasons? So what if your reasoning's wrong? Call his indifference mystery. Call his arrogance intellect. All you've got to lose is your heart and a little self-respect. If you've got arrogance and indifference, you can make them pay. They're the most commercial product on the romantic market today. What do you think I feel for you, or think of you? How sophisticated do you think I am? That's not a fair question, because obviously I don't even know how to answer it. I overestimated myself. I thought I could be with the big kids, the grown-ups, the ones who ask questions like they already know the answers, who never give themselves away, no emotional souvenirs. What's happening to me? Who the hell do I think I am? Why have I become casually involved with someone who, if I am totally honest with myself, I don't care for, and who doesn't care for me, and is married? I must figure this thing out once and for all, this pattern of becoming obsessed with inaccessible men. I think I've just about covered the boards by now. I think I've bled it dry. First, homosexual men, already established in their inaccessibility before I came along, so I couldn't take it too personally, just personally enough to get the taste in my mouth. The taste of disinterest and abandonment, sort of like cottage cheese with an aftertaste similar to smoked haddock. From then on, it seemed I couldn't get enough. As it were, as it seems to be. I started with snacking on the inaccessibility of random silent jerks, and seemed to have arrived at making a full meal of it. Now I've had more than enough. I want the check. Waiter? Thanks for the good times. Thank you for being so generous with what you have withheld. Thank you for being the snake in my grass, the thorn in my side, the pain in my ass, the knife in my back, the wrench in my works, the fly in my ointment, my Achilles heart, caught in a whirlpool without an anchor, relaxing into it, calmly going under for one of many last times. I've got to learn something from my mistakes instead of establishing a new record to break. Maybe stop fooling around with all these human beings and fall in love with the chair. It would have everything that the immediate situation has to offer, and less, which is obviously what I need. Less emotional and intellectual feedback, less warmth, less approval, less patience, and less response. The less the merrier. Chairs. They're always there when you need them, and while their staying implies total devotion, they still manage to remain aloof, noncommittal, and insensitive. Immovable and loyal. Reliable and unconsoling. Chairs it is. I must furnish my heart with feelings for furniture. But with these human beings, you never know. They might not want to hurt you. They might even like you. And that would be the worst possible thing that could happen. Because what can you do with people that like you, except, of course, inevitably disappoint them? It's very dangerous to have someone like you. Because one day, he'll find that you're not the person he thought you were. He'll end up someday having only one thing in common with you, and that'll be a shared sense of contempt and disgust for you. Of course you knew all along how foolish and worthless you were. You just hoped that if you crouched down behind yourself enough, he wouldn't see it. But one day, when your guard is off duty, you see him see. You both catch you at yourself, catch you behaving, and then you're lost. No, you were lost all along. Don't offer me love. I seek disinterest and denial. Tenderness makes my skin crawl. Understanding is vile. When you offer me happiness, you offer too much. My ideal is a long-lasting longing for someone whom I cannot quite touch. I am the only one who can come to my rescue. I am the only one who can help me now. But I don't know how to help myself. It must follow then that I don't want to help myself, that I want to completely drain myself of all hope, which will leave me safe and dry with nothing to lose. The point where it can only get better if I allowed it to get better. I can't focus on the good things. There are good things going on all around me, but I don't trust them. I can't make use of them, don't have the time for them. I'm too preoccupied with my precious panic. It seems to be demanding almost all of my attention. My own